The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
My guest this time on What's Your Story is Dr. Christine A. Anderson. She's an associate professor of history at Richard Bland College, who taught a course at the University of Richmond's Osher Institute this semester on Downton Abbey as a means of examining British society and culture of the period. And we'll get to Downton Abbey in a minute, but I want to start, Christine, with a question that we start every one of these programs with, and that's, what's your earliest childhood memory?
Okay, let me think. I have a few early childhood memories, but I think the one that's probably the earliest is actually reading a book outside. It was actually in Oklahoma. My parents were living in graduate student housing. My dad was a graduate student. And I was 4 years old, and I was sitting out on the front steps, if you will, reading a book to one of my friends, whose name was George. I don't really remember a whole lot about George, except that he was my friend. I liked him. He didn't know how to read, and I knew how to read, and so I would read books with him, and he came from Africa. I don't know where, but we would read books, and then he would invite me over, and we would have the Coca-Cola in the old glass bottles that his mom always had, and that's one of my earliest memories.
it really is a fascinating subject, and yeah. I get such a breadth of answers from people. You were Oklahoma.
Yeah, that's where my parents were at the time. But because I moved around my whole life.
So. You were in graduate school.
My dad was, yeah. He was working on a philosophy degree, a master's in philosophy at the University of Oklahoma.
And he got it?
He did. He did.
And so that took him away from Oklahoma, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, it was kind of a hiatus in a way for him anyway. From there, we moved on to Michigan. My dad was actually, he is a Presbyterian minister, and he had been in a PhD program in California in cross-cultural religions, which he stopped, and then went and served a church in Louisiana, which is where I was born, and then he decided to go back to school and get actually a master's in philosophy, and that's when they went to Oklahoma. But then from there, he went back and started serving a church again in Michigan, and we just kept moving from there.
Where did you go to elementary school? I mean, what's
A couple places. That would be in Gaylord, Michigan, and also, let's see, Windsor, Connecticut, or actually technically Pequannock. It was a little tiny town close to Windsor, Connecticut. So that was elementary school. And then also Plainville, Massachusetts. So we've kind of moved a lot. Uh-huh. That covered all of my elementary school.
And high school?
High school was in Wrentham, Massachusetts. So I was there for junior high and high school. So.
And then you went on to college.
Yes. I went to the College of Worcester in Ohio, in Worcester, Ohio. And from there, when I graduated, I went to D.C. I lived in D.C., Washington, D.C., and worked as a historian. I didn't even know you could get a job as a historian with just a bachelor's degree in history, and I did. In public history, I did a lot of research working for litigation and for a number of different historical projects with a company called History Associates Incorporated. And then I decided to go back to graduate school, and I went out to Kansas. So in the meantime, my parents had moved to Illinois when I was in college. So
so everything but the West Coast and the Deep South, it sounds like.
Well, I was born in Louisiana, but yeah, I hadn't really lived in the Deep South. Not on the West Coast at all. So yeah, pretty much Eastern Seaboard. I'm very comfortable. I probably spent half of my life in the Northeastern Seaboard and half of my life in the Midwest. So I'm very comfortable in both places.
I want to go back on something. You're a preacher's kid.
Yes.
Which version of a preacher's kid did you turn out to be?
Oh, I'm the good girl.
Are you?
Yeah.
Are you?
I'm the good girl. I'm an only child. I had a little different upbringing, not just the moving around. My mother comes from Finland, so I am
really?
A dual citizen as well. So she came from a very different background.
Do you speak Finnish?
I do not. I know some words and phrases here and there. It is a very difficult language, and one that my mom was speaking with me when I was young, but my father doesn't speak it. And I think what kind of happened is when I started to go to school more regularly, you know, we kind of lost it because I probably put a guilt trip on my mom or something and saying, well, dad's not speaking it. Why do I have to speak it? And it's one of those things that we both really regret. And I've tried to learn it since then through family, but it's really kind of difficult. It's a very difficult language. I mean, it has 14 cases. It's all these prepositions. It's not near any other sort of language. It's not like, it doesn't belong to the Scandinavian languages, for example.
Or the Romance languages.
Right. It's very different. So it's one of those things, particularly as an academic, like, I need a proper course. You know, I need to learn, you know, the steps and work through the book and all of those things. And it's a very difficult language to find a course here in the United States for. There are places, sure, but you have to live in those places. And I don't live in any of those places currently. So.
Have you been to Finland?
Oh, yeah, many times. I was actually just there in July. We went and took my daughter, who's now 18 months, but we went over to Finland to see some of my family that were still there who hadn't seen my daughter yet. And
this is a naive question, mm-hmm, but what's Finland like? What's it like in Finland?
Oh, well, I think it's wonderful. I love it. It's beautiful. It's very clean. They are very in tune with the environment. And what I mean by that is not just being like green and, you know, recycling and things like that, but even their architecture and their sensibility combine sort of the natural world with sort of the modern. So you see a lot of, you know, natural wood combined with, you know, the modern elements of like glass and steel. And it's a very practical culture. Everything that is used and made there is for a purpose or multiple purposes. There's not a lot of waste. It's very quiet. There aren't a lot of people who live in Finland there's a lot of green space. And so you don't have, I think sometimes, even in Helsinki, the capital city, it's not the same hustle and bustle that you're going to get in some place like London or New York or you know, even DC or something like that. It's still got a quiet reserve to it. The people are very reserved. They're very shy. They're very quiet.
Do they see you as a brash American?
No, because I don't act like a brash American. I'm a hybrid, so I'm just as comfortable in Europe as I am in the United States, and I do switch myself a little bit because that's part of who I am, but also I understand the culture. So, no, usually when I'm there, people assume I'm Finnish, which I'm half Finnish, but, you know, they just assume I'm a citizen, so, yeah.
Is Finland, like so much of Scandinavia in our fantasies, are they all blue-eyed blondes like you?
No, they are not.
Is that Finnish, your Finnish heritage?
That is. I mean, what I look like is, yes, it comes from my a little bit of both sides of my family, even the American side, too. So I kind of got the double whammy. But definitely the high cheekbones, yes, for sure. That is very typical. But the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you see that more in the western portions of Finland because that's where there's been a lot of Swedish influence because Finland was under Swedish control historically for quite some time. But in the eastern portions, and actually like my grandmother came from the eastern portions, and my mom actually has much more olive complexion and darker hair than I do. She looks more like her mother. From the eastern portions, much more dark hair, darker complexion, dark eyes, because you have more of that Russian influence and Karelian influence. So it does really depend on where you are in Finland.
The stereotypes are stereotypes.
Yes, exactly.
They're generalizations.
Yes, yeah.
You obviously care a lot about your Finnish
I do. And I think when I was younger, I didn't, you know, it was one of those things where nobody knew where Finland was. And it was totally different from anything else. And I don't think I appreciated it. And I think my mom, she was a little sad about that or wished that I would care about it more. But it's one of those things that you get older and you mature and you learn more about the world. And of course, I started studying history more. And you also leave home. And when you leave home, you start to really carry, you know, you hang on to those traditions. And you start to really appreciate things in ways that maybe you didn't before. And then never mind, you know, ultimately getting married and becoming a mother yourself, it becomes very important.
Are you a mother?
I am.
How many children?
Just one. I have a daughter, and she's 18 months old right now. And
that's right. You mentioned her already.
Yeah. So.
And you took her to Finland to show her off.
Yes, we did. It was very interesting. It was her first plane trip, which is, of course, an international trip, no less, and first boat ride and bus ride. I mean, we basically did all these first time to the beach, everything when we were there. But yeah, so my aunt still lives there, and my cousin, who's my age, currently lives in Sweden, but she's from Finland. So she came over to visit, and my parents have a condo there that's kind of shared by the family. And so they came over, and so it was just kind of a nice big visit. And we had other friends in Europe who came, since we were going to be there, it's like, oh, we'll come up. And so, you know, get a chance to see everybody. And particularly my aunt hadn't seen my daughter yet, and neither had my cousin. And so that was important for them to be able to see her.
What's her daughter's name?
Cecilia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Good old Finnish name.
Yeah, it's not a Finnish name at all. She does have one of her middle names is a Finnish name. It's Auliki, which is actually my mother's middle name. So she has her grandmother's middle name. Well, one of her middle names is from her grandmother. So. But yeah, she's actually named after the patron saint of music, Saint Cecilia.
Really?
So yeah.
Is this an aspiration on your part?
Yes, because I'm a musician.
You're a musician too?
Yes, I am.
What's your instrument?
I'm a classically trained violinist, and I specialize in Baroque violin and in historically informed performance is what we tend to call it now. So Baroque ensembles on period instruments.
Period instruments.
Yes, yes.
So
yes.
That's what historically informed
means? It's a combination. It's a combination of using the period instruments itself. So in my case, a Baroque violin does look different from a modern violin you would see in a symphony. Mm-hmm. It is a little bit smaller. It doesn't have a chin rest, doesn't have a shoulder rest. The bridge is different. It has gut strings made of sheep's gut instead of the synthetic core, the steel strings. And you use a different bow as well. But also, we're talking about technique, how you actually play the music on the instrument. So there's one thing of using the instrument, but some of the technique you use. For example, in a lot of more, you know, sort of using the modern violin and music that's really, in many ways, coming out of the tradition of the Romantic and the contemporary 20th century music, things like that, you use a lot of vibrato where you're moving the hand back and forth. And you know, singers do this too. You know, when they sing, they have a lot of, you know, a lot of vibrato in their voice. And even modern orchestras, if they're playing Baroque music, they might use those modern techniques and connect notes more often. In Baroque technique, it's going to be different. You don't use vibrato. You use a lot of open strings because the sheep's gut actually resounds beautifully. By learning how to apply just the right pressure to make this gorgeous sort of blossoming of sound. The technique in terms of how you use the bow, it's different as well. So it's a combination of things.
How big a role does your music play in your life now?
Always been very important. It's always been probably very central. In the last couple of years, I had to take a little bit of a break because I had a child, and that, right. That of course, she became my center. But so, you know, I didn't completely stop it, but I had to, you know, cut back quite a bit. But it's really coming back into the forefront. I'm currently playing with a Baroque ensemble here in Richmond. So I don't have time for doing the modern and the Baroque. So if I have to choose one, I choose the Baroque right now.
You've got so many balls in the air, but we've neglected your professional interest, which is British history. All of it, or?
My doctorate's in modern British history. I mean, I can teach all of it, but my specialty in terms of my research really is the late 19th and early 20th century Britain. Sort of late Victorian or Edwardian period, but I'm sort of a cultural historian and a gender historian. So my research really dealt with...
Gender
yes.
Historian, okay.
So really dealt with looking at the role of middle-class women in society, and more specifically, looking at how they develop their political consciousness. So I was looking at experiences, sort of opportunities that are starting to open up in Britain in the late 19th and early 20th century that provided new occupations that they can possibly do coming out of the home, such as teaching or nursing or secretarial work or shop assistants, but also looking at, for the first time, middle-class women on the stage. That was something that was really shunned for a very long time. Women who were on the stage were akin to prostitutes, right. Whether they were or weren't. That's exactly. Just how they were seen. But that starts to shift in the late 19th and early 20th century with variety theaters and changes in music halls. And so looking at their experiences on the stage and looking at their experiences in kind of the cultural environment of London and how that shaped their political consciousness. And many of those women got active in the women's suffrage movement and really created a sort of a unique female politics that embodied the stage and theatrical elements and the use of sort of artistry and music and all of these things that they were doing, either this is how they were educated for a long time or what they were doing on the stage, and now putting it into practice as politics in an effort to fight for the vote.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that we're talking with Dr. Christine A. Anderson, who is an associate professor of history at Richard Bland College, who taught a course at the University of Richmond's Osher Institute this semester on Downton Abbey as a means of examining British society and culture of the period. And that leads us right into Downton Abbey. We were talking about Julian Fellowes, mm-hmm. who's the creator and writer of the Downton Abbey series, who is just brilliant. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that, and I'm a Downton Abbey fan, one of the things I've noticed over the 4 or 5 years the series has been on, is how he started with the sinking of the Titanic.
Right.
And he has tracked the telephone, transportation.
Mm-hmm.
He's had a lot of interesting episodes featuring Thomas, the butler, mm-hmm. who is experimenting and his own sexuality and paying the consequences. Mm-hmm. What is the secret, do you think? History is not altogether sort of a party-throwing interest, and yet Downton Abbey has captured people's imagination, and it's marketing. It's because he is marketing history through a drama, which is, as one critic called it, Dallas with very posh accents. Why did you want to teach a course on Downton Abbey? Is it because you can illustrate your topic with it?
In many ways, yeah. When Downton Abbey started, and of course it started in that period before World War I, in the Edwardian period, so it was right in with my research. I started watching this, and I was just really impressed. Clearly, it's not a documentary. It's not a historical documentary. You know, it is a drama, as you said, and that's one of the lures of it, and it's fantastic, and we all love a good drama, a soap opera, if you will. But for me as a historian, as a British historian, I was so impressed with all of the things that they were putting in there that were so spot on in terms of historical accuracy. Now, I'm not going to say that everything is accurate in there because it's also fiction, and it's drama. And there are some things, if you were to show the accuracy of it, people aren't going to want to watch it. Like how, you know, the relationship between upstairs and downstairs and how servants really were treated in that period, it's not going to be something that people want to watch because it was pretty bad. It was very, very sort of savage in many ways. So by portraying Lord Grantham as being this sort of very magnanimous, good lord to work for. I'm not saying that they didn't exist, but generally speaking, the position for the servants downstairs would have been a lot worse than what they're showing. So there are inaccuracies. But with that said, there is so much that is done well that is historically accurate. You even picked up on some of them. Some of the nuances. Sometimes it's not a line. Sometimes it's not even a big scene. It's just some random thing they show, like the telegraph being used, right?
Right.
A big aspect of you know, the Industrial Revolution. There's a scene where Lady Mary gets out of the first class of the train and Mr. Bates gets out of the third class. Right. You know, first, second, third, that was based on classes. That is also a product of the Industrial Revolution, which is so, so well done. Even little things about when they're sitting at the table, when they, you know, whether it's just the intimate dinner or whether they actually have guests, if you never notice, they're always talking on one side until the lady of the house, Cora, turns, and then everybody else is able to turn. I mean, these are nuances that some people might pick up, some people may not pick up. And then other times, they'll just put out a very simple line, they don't go into too much detail, and they move on, where they might mention some sort of historical reference. There's just little things like that that they do so well. And for anybody who just loves the drama, you're getting great drama, you're getting great sort of visual images, costumes are great, and you know, some of the set design and the mannerisms and the personalities. But then if you know something about British history, there's so many more layers there. And the more that you know, they've done a really good job of hitting every single one of those layers.
Another thing that I've learned since I started watching Downton Abbey was a little bit about how many wealthy American heiresses did marry, as Cora did, for the title. I won't say that was Cora's sole motivation, but she married, she had the money,
right.
He had the land and no money.
Mm-hmm.
And the marriage of these American heiresses, in many ways, provided the capital for these grand country homes to continue.
Correct.
And for the families to continue.
Yes.
And that's a point that's being made on Downton Abbey. It's not being driven into anybody's head or pounded into their head, but it's an eye-opener, I think, to a lot of Americans.
Yeah, and that follows very traditional British historiography. I mean, on this, historians have been talking about, and there's different interpretations of the sort of the rise and the fall of the British aristocracy and how, you know, how traditional is it, right? When there have been people sort of marrying in, I mean, there's an interpretation of earlier in the 17th and 18th centuries that it's not just an English aristocracy. You have the Scottish and the Irish and even the Welsh sort of mixing that up. And then we have another sort of influx of this, as you're talking about in Downton Abbey shows, in the 19th and 20th century of a lot of Americans that kind of come into this because they do save some of these estates that have gone into financial ruin for one reason or another. And so that making of the British aristocracy, we tend to think of it as being something that is so longstanding and so steeped in tradition, and this is true, and I'm not saying that it isn't, but historians and scholars have been looking at it. There's a lot more nuances. It's not as static as people thought it was for a very long time. So they're doing a good job, I think, of bringing in sort of the current perspective or understanding of that, even in sort of scholarship circles. So
you mentioned something a few minutes ago that I've got to go back to because it really captured my attention. The brutality with which the downstairs staff is apparently much greater than I had realized. I mean, I've watched Downton Abbey and upstairs downstairs well.
Yeah.
And they're treated like laborers.
Yeah.
But was it more brutal than
it is? It is. I mean, we're talking about, you know, days that are, you know, they're working 14, 15, 16-hour days. The quarters that they have in Downton Abbey are quite nice, I think, for servants for that period of time. Usually, it does depend on the house, right? And it does depend if you are working for an aristocratic family in a country home versus a London home, or if you're working for a middle-class family. You got to understand the middle classes are going to mimic the aristocracy, and they will have some servants as well. But their houses are smaller, and so therefore the servants' quarters can be smaller as well. They can be subject to a damp basement or a very, very hot, dry attic with not a whole lot, you know, in terms of possessions, right? A bed, you know, a dresser, that might be it. So you are subject to the elements as well. But yeah, their hours were very long. The drudgery of some of that, it does depend on what position you were, because as you can tell, and they are right in this, there is a hierarchy downstairs as well, with Carson, of course, being,
they're mimicking what...
Oh, of course, it's a mirror image. Absolutely. It's two sides of the same coin. And then, of course, poor Daisy, you know, being at the drudgery then. And her job was the worst. And they do a pretty good job of showing some of that. But what I mean by this is, like, you know, there are times where in the show, you know, the servants are kind of given, like, you know, some time off, or they're able to go to the festival, or, oh, you know, let bring them up for the concert of the famous opera singer or whatever the case may be. That's, you know, I'm not saying that there weren't nice lords who maybe did that, but that was not typical. They were really to not be seen and to not be heard unless they needed to serve, obviously, in the dining room. We're talking...
No emotion was, forgive me for using the word wasted, but the upstairs did not waste much of its emotion on the downstairs.
No, they really didn't. And so even so much so that, you know, there were rules that if you were passing by, like if you were like the equivalent of Daisy or Anna or one of those, where you were passing by his lordship or one of the ladies or somebody from upstairs, you were really expected to turn yourself into the wall, to not make eye contact and turn your body into the wall. And the idea was to save the servant from embarrassment, from having to be in the same presence as your master, so to speak, those who employ you. Things like that they're not necessarily showing, right? There seems to be a little bit more of a relationship there. The other thing that they show in Downton Abbey, which isn't really entirely true, is there does seem to be a sense of loyalty of the servants towards the family. And again, I won't say, you know, we're always making generalizations. You can always, for everything I say, I'm sure you can find, you know, exception. And there are exceptions, don't get me wrong. But generally speaking, servants did not have loyalty to the families they worked for. I mean, there are tons and tons of cases of aristocratic families and records that show how many servants they went through. You know, if they could find a better position, if they could sell somebody out and, you know, and work their way up, you know, to a better position, they would. So I think actually characters like Thomas and like Mrs. O'Brien and those, that they are actually more typical. The scheming and trying to, you know, work themselves up, and then ultimately O'Brien leaves, you know, and goes off to India and gets a better position. You know, it's a better, you know, sort of life for her. That's actually more typical.
A Carson in real life who is the Rock would have been hard to find.
Well, he is typical in his sense of tradition because butlers were at the top of the chain of the hierarchy and how important that is and how, you know, maintaining standards, right? And the standards of downstairs do reflect upstairs. But in terms of his specific loyalty to the family, this right. almost like personal connection that he has, that this is his family because he doesn't have any. Yeah, I think that's a little more unusual. Yeah, yeah. And again, I wouldn't say that it wouldn't happen, but it's more the atypical than typical.
If you were not a historian and this were not your field, would you still be a fan?
Oh, yeah. I think so.
It's
I think so. Yeah. And I love it. I'm like, I still watch soap operas. I love that stuff, you know, and Italian operas and Shakespeare. I mean, these are all soap operas in a way, right? It all goes back to like Greek tragedy and comedy. And there's a whole legacy there, I think. And it's a good storyline. It really is. I mean, you want to know what's going to happen next. And everybody's waiting for the dowager to say whatever she's going to say, because it's going to be hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
But she is also really true to form. She's representing a certain generation and a certain class and a certain time where all these changes are taking place. And there are a lot of changes. That's what's great about Downton Abbey, the period that they've been focusing on. There is a lot that's changing in British society. And it's very interesting to see where she sort of holds the line and says, well, this I'm not budging on. And then other times where she ends up being more modern than you think she is. You
yes,
know what I mean?
Exactly.
And more worldly than you think she is, right?
Yes.
I think that was one of the things that's always excited me about this period in history and why I based my research on that, is this transition. You can't say it's this or that because it's both at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I always tell my students, you know, when we think about sort of stages in history or changes in time, like historians have done all this after the fact, you know, what distinguishes the Middle Ages from the Renaissance, right? Or the early modern period or the modern period. It's not like a light switch. It's not like one day like, oh, I'm sitting in the Middle Ages. Next day I'm in the Renaissance. It doesn't work that way, right? There is transition there,
yes.
But there's enough of a shift. It might even be 100 years that this shift is taking place, but there's enough to recognize that it is something new. And I think that's what's interesting when we start getting into like the late 19th, early 20th century, 1920s. Now we're actually seeing change happen at the quickest pace it has. Up to that point in time, in at least in the Western world, but at the same time, people are still trying to hold on. When you have that much change, it forces you to want to hold on to the things that are stable and the things that you totally understand. So even though there are these opportunities for women, doesn't mean that women still don't want to get married and have kids and don't necessarily want to work. There are others who are saying, yeah, but I want the vote, you know, and they're excited by the changes. So you're always going to have the people who are seeing them as dangerous and unsure and you know, fearful, and those who are like, oh, this is great and exciting. Lady Rose is that new generation, you know, of everything's exciting, and who cares about the past? And that, why do we have these silly rules, right? But, you know, there are those who say, but there is stability in some of those rules, so let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
there's almost like Julian Fellowes has crafted a character to represent every attitude and every situation. Perhaps not every, that's too strong a word. But
yeah, a general sort of overview, you might say, of, yeah, the various different perspectives. Yeah, I think that's accurate.
But it's also education.
It is. It absolutely is. And it's fun. So yeah, I'll sit there and watch, you know, with my husband. And my husband's a historian too, but not in British history. So it's fun because we'll sit there and watch. And he gets a lot of the references and you know, and of course the storyline's so great. But every once in a while they'll throw something out and he's like, okay, hang on, pause it. Okay, all right, give me the backstory here. What's going on? And so it's great fun. It's great fun. So
it's been a real... a lot of fun to talk to you too.
It's been my pleasure.
This is a subject we could spend an hour on.
I think so.
our guest today has been Dr. Christine Anderson, an associate professor of history at Richard Bland College, who taught a course at the University of Richmond's Osher Institute this semester on Downton Abbey as a means of examining the true story behind British society and culture of the period. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Don Dale, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice for What's Your Story?
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477, and be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.